China was one of Donald Trump's biggest talking points on the campaign trail. He focused in particular on the economic aspect of the relationship. He repeatedly criticized U.S. leaders for letting China beat them in trade. He also accused China of devaluing its currency, the renminbi, or the yuan. But he also talked about security issues. He criticized China's activity in the South China Sea. He said the United States needed to have a stronger military presence in the Asia-Pacific region. During a trade speech in Pennsylvania in June, when then-candidate Trump laid out his vision for trade deals, he made a few points to talk about how he would respond to China once in office.
I'm going to instruct my Treasury Secretary to label China a currency manipulator, which should have been done years ago. Any country that devalues their currency in order to take unfair advantage of the United States, which is many countries, will be met with sharply. And that includes tariffs and taxes. I'm going to instruct the U.S. Trade Representative to bring trade cases against China, both in this country and at the WTO. If China does not stop its illegal activities, including its theft of American trade secrets, I will use every lawful present. Hey, look, this is very easy. This is so easy. I love saying this. I will use every lawful presidential power to remedy trade disputes.
I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
And I'm Robert McMahon, Managing Editor of CFR.org.
You're listening to The President's Inbox, a CFR podcast that examines the challenges that President-elect Donald Trump will face after Inauguration Day on January 20, 2017. On this show, we talk about the issues that he will find at the top of his inbox when he arrives in the Oval Office. We're going to discuss what he has said he will do, what his priorities might be, and what challenges he could likely confront. This week, we're going to talk about China. How will President-elect Trump handle that priority during his administration?
And with us this week to help examine that is CFR's Elizabeth Economy. She is a senior fellow and director of Asia Studies here at the Council. Her expertise includes Chinese domestic and foreign policy, U.S.-China relations, and her most recent book is By All Means Necessary, How China's Resource Quest is Changing the World. It's a great exploration of how China's determined efforts to expand its economy are affecting the country and the world at large. Liz, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Bob.
Well, we're going to talk about a lot of things, especially economic points, but there's something fresh from the headlines that is still reverberating, and that, of course, is the phone call between the Taiwanese president, Tsai Ing-wen, and President-elect Trump, which is, I believe, one of the first in decades between leaders of the two entities. Many foreign policy experts are raising questions about how this might affect U.S.-China relations. What are your thoughts on that?
Right. There's certainly been a lot of ink spilled on this issue. I think there are really two issues at stake. First, you know, was the acceptance of this phone call just a one-off play, meaning that it doesn't have any larger significance in the U.S.-Taiwan relationship? Is the U.S., for example, going to allow U.S. officials to meet with their Taiwanese counterparts or allow President Tsai Ing-wen to visit the United States and meet with various officials? The truth is that Taiwan is a great example of post-war transition from an authoritarian to a democratic nation like Japan and South Korea. It has a lot of fans in Congress and also within some parts of the business and foreign policy community. So there's been a yearning, I would say, within some quarters in Washington to grant Taiwan some form of greater recognition. But again, whether this phone call is part of a longer-term play or just a one-off moment in time, we don't know. We don't have any clarity on this issue either from the president-elect or from any of his advisors. The first response from the Chinese government was from the foreign minister, Wang Yi, and his response was quite measured, quite tempered. He laid all of the blame at the feet of Taiwan and President Tsai Ing-wen, saying that it was a trick, you know, from the Taiwanese playbook. And that, you know, could have given President-elect Trump some room to maneuver, but instead he doubled down and followed the phone call with a number of tweets that basically accused, you know, and criticized China for currency manipulation, trade violations, and for its military buildup in the South China Sea. That in turn precipitated, quite an outcry from the Chinese, Chinese scholars and foreign policy people, as well as just the broad Chinese public, much of which, frankly, had been quite supportive of President-elect Trump. A lot of them were very, very upset by his attack on China and then sort of this seeming opening to Taiwan.
Liz, could you explain for us why the phone call in of itself would alarm leaders in Beijing? I think for many Americans, they hear that the president of Taiwan called the president-elect of the United States, and they say that's a very nice thing to do. And they're a bit puzzled by the reaction that they're seeing in Beijing.
Right, and their reaction is the same one that President-elect Trump had, which is this is a very nice thing for this president of this nation to do. You know, basically, we don't have diplomatic relations with Taiwan. You know, we don't recognize Taiwan as a country. It doesn't have standing as a country in the United Nations. We broke off our formal diplomatic relation, 40-some years ago and recognized the People's Republic of China as the sole government of China. In doing this, in sort of taking this phone call, it's as even though President-elect Trump is not yet president, it's within the context of him becoming president. And so this is the first time since the early 1980s that you've had any direct conversation between, well, a president-elect and the president of Taiwan. So it really breaks, a very long-standing diplomatic precedent and seems to indicate that we are changing the rules of the game that have been well established, again, for decades.
So obviously there's a whole host of economic issues to talk about, and one of them is currency manipulation. This was referenced in President-elect Trump's tweets that followed up the brouhaha over the call from the Taiwanese leader. President-elect had this to say at one of his rallies about the issue.
Countries have taken advantage of the United States like never, ever, ever before. They're money manipulators. They're currency manipulators. They cut the value of their currencies at points where, for some reason, we never, ever talk retribution. And we're going to get our businesses back. We're going to get our businesses back.
So, Liz, what can we say about what might actually be part of the first steps the president-elect takes?
Well, I think once President-elect Trump assumes his office and looks at the facts, he may, in fact, change some of his tune. China actually doesn't meet all three of the conditions to be labeled a currency manipulator. It does have a trade surplus with the United States that exceeds $20 billion. That's one condition. But it does not have an account surplus that is lower than 3%. And rather than actively devaluing its currency to make it cheaper for China to enable more of its exports, right now, it is extremely concerned about how much the value of the renminbi has actually fallen and is seeking ways to prevent capital flight. So, you know, of the three issues, the three conditions that the White House has for labeling somebody a currency manipulator, China actually only meets one at this point in time. So I would imagine that there will be an enormous pushback on the president if he, in fact, tries to move forward with this. It's entirely possible that his advisors will inform him that this actually doesn't make sense at this point in time. So I would hope, frankly, that he would take a step back from this play.
And actually, as our colleague Brad Setzer has written on his blog, there's also it's a counterproductive step in terms of U.S. interests being directly affected if they take this route.
Yeah, absolutely. It will hurt the relationship and it will hurt U.S. companies that are exporting to the United States, the Walmarts and others that produce an enormous or buy an enormous amount in China and export to the U.S. But even if you took that out of the equation, it simply doesn't meet the standard for being labeled a currency manipulator.
I'll note, Liz, that President Trump has said he's going to declare China a currency manipulator on day one. So we'll see if he actually goes forward with this. But obviously, the currency issue is embedded in a broader critique that President Trump has of U.S. trade relations with China. In essence, he's argued that China has taken advantage of the international trading system we set up. We have a clip on just that point.
China doesn't free trade with us, by the way, just so you know. You know, Boeing is building massive plants in China. Be careful. Be careful. You have a beautiful plant in South Carolina. You have a beautiful plant. Be careful, because when they cut the value of their currency in 2 years after their plants are built, and you find out you're losing your business, not going to happen if Trump is president, that I can tell you. But be careful.
Given what candidate Trump has said, Liz. What do you expect him actually to do on the trade front?
You know, he has very limited powers, actually, to take action. He, as the chief executive, without engaging Congress, he has the power to levy unilaterally a 15% tariff on Chinese goods coming into the country. So he could, in fact, do this. Again, it may be that he is counseled by his advisors, that their pressure is brought to bear on him from U.S. companies that would pay a price for this. But that is the one significant act that he could take, very decisive act that he could take against China. You know, beyond that, I think he should be thinking in a far more proactive and positive way, because the Obama administration will be leaving office having made significant progress on a bilateral investment treaty with China. And over the long term, in terms of helping U.S. companies get fair access, you know, in China to do business, that is a much more constructive way to approach the relationship than to try to think through all the different punitive actions that the U.S. government might take. My hope is that, you know, once he gets his bearings and he gets his cabinet and, you know, all the people in place, that they begin to sort of develop a real strategy for dealing with China and for this trade issue, as opposed to these sort of one-off measures that, you know, may not, in fact, or likely will not sort of lead to the outcome that he really desires.
And so his designation of an ambassador, which just happened, that sends some signals, yes?
Right. I think the nomination of Governor Branstad of Iowa to be the next ambassador to China is likely to be received by the Chinese as perhaps the very first positive signal that they've received from the incoming Trump administration. You know, Governor Branstad has spoken very favorably of China for, you know, 30-odd years. He's had a relationship with the Chinese government as the governor, going to China, traveling to China to promote Iowa and promote agricultural products. The Chinese themselves say that Governor Branstad is a Lao Peng Yo, which means, you know, an old friend, which is a very positive designation. So you have, I think, President-elect Trump putting in place and letting the Chinese know that, in fact, he does hear them, and he's putting in his ambassador somebody that will be quite committed to keeping the relationship on an even keel.
One of the areas that these two countries have enormous stakes in is obviously North Korea and the growing threat of a North Korean nuclear program, not only for the region, but actually for, you know, eventually missiles possibly reaching U.S. mainland. Liz, can you talk a little bit about what are the challenges facing the incoming administration in dealing with that file, so to speak, and how it can work with China to try to lessen that threat?
You know, I think over the past, you know, certainly over the Obama administration, and even before that, the United States has looked to China as one of the most important partners in trying to address this challenge of nuclear North Korea. We haven't always gotten the type of cooperation from China that we would have liked. We have looked to China to be much tougher, generally speaking, on North Korea than it has been. China has enormous leverage. It is by far the largest provider of energy to North Korea, as well as food aid. It has the potential to turn the screws on North Korea if it wants to.
And it just contributed to that, actually.
It did. And the most recent UN sanctions, China also is the largest importer of North Korean coal and copper. And it is significantly, you know, decreasing its purchases by, you know, two-thirds or so. So this was a really important step. I think in some ways, one of the most significant measures that China has adopted to try to put some pressure on North Korea. So I think, you know, hopefully President-elect Trump will look at this sort of new elevated level of cooperation and think that, you know, it's important for us to continue along this path. You know, China's quite concerned about THAAD, the missile defense system that the United States and South Korea are putting in place. And Beijing has begun to take some punitive actions against South Korean companies. I think this is something that President-elect Trump is going to have to deal with as well, this sort of Chinese concern over this. But I think... you know, it's imperative, frankly, that we work with the Chinese on this. Having said that, there's some noise being made in Beijing right now among some analysts in the foreign policy community that, in fact, you know, if the Trump administration doesn't play nice with China, that in fact maybe they'll just stop helping us with North Korea. But I think it's important to recognize that there's no love lost between President Xi Jinping and Kim Jong-un. They have yet to meet, which is really unheard of for the two leaders of, you know, North Korea and China. And there are a lot of people in the China foreign policy community that believe that North Korea is a millstone around China's neck. So they have their own internal debates and pressures that will push them to taking a tougher line in North Korea. So I don't think we should bend over because we think that for some reason China is not going to work with us on North Korea if we're tougher on other issues.
Liz, I take your point on North Korea being a critical issue in U.S.-China relations going ahead. I think many people would argue that North Korea has the potential to be the first big crisis that a Trump presidency has to face. And I also take your point that the Chinese have done more in terms of putting pressure on North Korea in recent months than they have before. But my sense is, sort of following what candidate Trump said and now President Trump has said, his view is that China may be doing some things, it's not doing enough. And indeed, he has talked about pushing China very hard to put pressure on North Korea to dismantle its program. And he's been quite specific about it. Here's a clip from one of his speeches.
Don't forget, we're like the piggy bank that's being robbed. We have the cards. We have a lot of power with China. When China doesn't want to fix the problem in North Korea, we say, sorry, folks, you got to fix the problem. Because we can't continue to allow China to rape our country. And that's what they're doing. It's the greatest theft in the history of the world.
So if President Trump acts in the way that candidate Trump promised to act, how do you see that playing in Beijing?
I'm not really sure what President Trump has in mind when he says that we're going to, you know, turn the screws on China or you know, take some sort of tougher action against them if they don't do more on North Korea. I don't see this playing very well in Beijing at all. Beijing does not react well to threats. And I think they believe that we are so economically interdependent at this point that if President-elect Trump were, or President Trump were to try to use whatever economic leverage he thought that the U.S. had, they would simply respond in kind. And I think, you know, Japan and South Korea, they also recognize that the United States and China need to work together on this issue of North Korea. So they're not really going to be interested in having President Trump pressure China to the point or try to undertake some other kinds of actions, you know, in the trade field to press China so that the relationship blows up in some way. You know, this is too important to have some kind of, to place that kind of gamble on.
What ways could China put pressure on the United States? How could it? What leverage does it have that it could exert in response?
Well, look, I mean, there are very small but significant steps that it could take. For example, you can look at what it's been doing to the South Korean company Lotte because of THAAD, which is, you know, just on one day, just walking into the company with scores of public security officials and saying, you know, open all of your books, we're taking your computers, we're basically investigating your company top to bottom. I mean, they could go and do this to any, you know, number of U.S. companies. They could make life miserable for U.S. companies in China. So that's one thing they could do. They could become much more assertive and aggressive in the South China Sea. They could declare an air defense identification zone. And there are a lot of different ways that China could cause trouble for the United States. So I think, again, I don't think there's any point in ratcheting up pressure on the U.S. side, because I think it will certainly result in a very negative response from China.
You know, and you mentioned the South China Sea, Liz. Could you describe a little bit about how the situation, what situation that President-elect Trump is going to inherit it from the Obama administration in terms of, you know, there are these freedom of navigation operations going on there. There's been consistent U.S., you know, warnings, and yet Chinese creation of sort of island assets and so forth in around the area, as well as inroads in the relations with the Philippines. Could you talk a little bit about where things stand there?
Right. So I think, you know, as President-elect Trump surveys sort of the maritime domain out in Asia, he's going to find a fairly complicated situation and one that I think the Obama administration is less happy with than it anticipated. So, you know, there was a ruling by the permanent court, the International Permanent Court of Arbitration last summer that basically said that China's claims to the Nine Dash Line, to, you know, more than 80% of the maritime area in the South China Sea, were basically without merit. And this was a suit that the Philippines had brought to the court. So this was considered a significant victory. And you had a number of people in Beijing saying, okay, you know, we don't recognize the court's ruling. And sort of there was a lot of noise surrounding it out of Beijing. But there were also a lot of people talking about how Beijing basically wanted to come to some kind of peaceful resolution of the situation, seemed to be wanting to take a step back. But the new president of the Philippines, Duterte, then sort of changed the game again, basically saying that, you know, he was going to move away from the United States, the alliance with the United States. He wanted to become closer to China, didn't like the way the United States was hitting on the Philippines' human rights practices. And then you had Malaysia also sort of indicating that it wasn't very happy with the United States and its investigation into all of the banking and money, financial issues surrounding some of the people in the Malaysian leadership. And so you ended up with two of the important actors in the region moving a little bit more toward China, seeming to be more accommodating to China. And that really did pull the rug out a little bit from underneath the United States and its position in the South China Sea. So where we stand now, I think, is that there's been a little bit of a lull. The Chinese have not been particularly active in the South China Sea over the past 6 months. Things have calmed down a little bit, not entirely, but they certainly haven't been moving forward on a land reclamation. They made some move to try to resolve the issue of Scarborough Shoal by removing some of their, this is the disputed area with the Philippines, by taking a step back and removing some of their assets. And then President Duterte said, well, guess what? Let's declare it a marine sanctuary. So that was a bold move on the part of President Duterte. But the Chinese aren't biting because they still claim it. And so that's a little bit of a standoff there. But I guess the broader point is things are, I would say, in a little bit of a holding pattern right now. But we shouldn't expect that they're going to stay that way.
Liz, how do you expect the Trump presidency to approach the issue of the South China Sea? On the one hand, President-elect Trump has said that he wants the United States to take a more forceful position on the issue. He's talked about building up American naval assets in the region. On the other hand, he says he is going to withdraw the United States from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, the major trade deal that the United States negotiated that was supposed to be sort of one of the cornerstones of the pivot to Asia that was supposed to sort of rally countries around the area of the South China Sea.
Right. So I think you've captured it exactly right, which is to say he has a much more assertive stance when it comes to the security issues in the South China Sea and the East China Sea. And the people around him that work on Asia at this point in time are quite hawkish. And so they're all talking about a pretty significant buildup, particularly of naval forces in the region. On the other hand, you know, the people around him on the trade side, and apparently he himself, don't see benefits from multilateral trade agreements. And so what he's talked about is, yes, just basically dropping the Trans-Pacific Partnership and moving forward with a series of bilateral trade agreements with certain key partners. You know, we'll have to wait to see. I think a lot of Asian leaders, a number of them, are of two minds. On the one hand, they very much hope that President Trump will take a step back from his promise to step back from the TPP on day one and rethink this. But on the other hand, they've got a different trade agreement sitting there and waiting for them. And that's one that the Chinese have been, you know, have structured primarily, called the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. And while the RCEP is not as significant a trade agreement, is not as high bar a trade agreement, nonetheless, it will afford a pretty significant decrease in tariffs on, you know, a wide range of goods for all these countries. And they are eager to move ahead with RCEP and then eventually to even larger free trade agreement of, in the Asia Pacific. I think it's unfortunate, but I think President Trump does seem to believe that a regional free trade agreement is not something that the United States needs.
And needless to say, we won't be hearing the term strategic pivot to Asia necessarily in the incoming administration?
I don't think we'll hear strategic pivot or rebalance, but I don't know that President Trump is prepared to step back fully from Asia. I don't see that, you know, coming from him. I think he recognizes, and certainly the people around him to date recognize, how important the region is, particularly economically, but also because you have issues like North Korea. So I'm not that concerned that we're going to see the U.S. withdraw from this incredibly important part of the world. What I am concerned about is whether or not they have thought through a kind of comprehensive strategy for the United States in the region. You know, does President Trump really understand what the Trans-Pacific Partnership means or meant in terms of not only, you know, trade issues and sort of long-term advantages for U.S. companies, because the rules of the game advantaged U.S. companies, right? The labor, intellectual property rights, environmental standards were all drawn to U.S. specifications. Does he realize that? And does he realize what it means for U.S. leadership in the region? So, you know, there's still some time. I guess we'll have to wait to see.
What about the incoming Trump administration's attitudes towards Northeast Asia, particularly America's two treaty allies there, South Korea and Japan? During the course of the campaign, candidate Trump indicated that he might be open to one or both of those countries becoming nuclear powers. He certainly indicated unhappiness about his perception that neither country was pulling its weight in terms of their defense. How do you see that all playing out?
I think we have not heard that kind of talk from President-elect Trump recently. And my best guess is that his advisors, his Asia advisors, have helped him to understand, first of all, just how much those two countries, South Korea and Japan in particular, contribute to that defense. For example, Japan contributes about 70% of the cost. And beyond that, you know, Prime Minister Abe was very smart. You know, he got in there right away and met with President-elect Trump.
First meeting with the
very
leader.
First, exactly, the very first meeting. And from all accounts, it was a positive one. And again, I would assume that Prime Minister Abe helped President-elect Trump understand the depth of the relationship, the extent to which Japan has and does support U.S. interests in the region, you know, is an effective representative in many respects for U.S. Interests. So we really haven't heard much about that recently. So I think maybe it's one of those areas that we've seen, you know, President-elect Trump, you know, also sort of take a step back, change his mind, you know, take a second look at an issue and realize that maybe he'd gotten out a little too far ahead of himself.
Well, we've seen a little bit of that movement, a little bit, on the issue of climate change, where he said he might not be willing to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement at last report. However, the U.S. had a very had made common cause with China on some important steps towards that Paris Agreement. Do we see that sort of stalemated for a little bit now, or with the incoming administration sort of being less interested in a very proactive climate policy, or we just have to wait and see?
I think we have to wait to see. You know, clearly, the proposed new head of the Environmental Protection Agency is not someone who believes that climate change is an issue that we need to take seriously. But we did just see President Trump meet with former Vice President Al Gore to discuss climate change. And President-elect Trump has said that there may be some connection there between human activity and climate change. So I think that's a very positive step. In terms of withdrawing from the Paris Agreement, in terms of the relationship between the United States and China as both, you know, countries leading the climate initiative globally and really, I think, bringing a lot of countries along with the two of them, I think that was important. But I also think it's important to remember that this process of the United States reducing its CO2 emissions, its greenhouse gas emissions, is well underway. And in many respects, it's unlikely that President-elect Trump can turn back the clock. We are shuttering coal plants now. Why? Not because of the Paris Agreement and climate change, but because natural gas is so inexpensive because of fracking. People, you know, companies like Google and Apple are pledging 100% energy going to come from renewable energy, you know, by 2020. So I think U.S. companies, in many respects, regions of the country, you know, Texas is the largest source of wind power, produces more wind power than any other state in the country. So I think regions of the country, U.S. companies are all on board to move forward with a clean energy future, whether or not the U.S. is part of the Paris Agreement.
Liz, over the course of the campaign, we saw a lot of reporting that Russia was trying to interfere with the American electoral system. We didn't hear any arguments like that or any claims like that about China. And I'm just wondering, from your vantage point, sort of looking ahead, what lessons do you think the Chinese drew from what they've seen during this presidential election? Would we expect China to emulate what appears to be Russian behavior or shy away from it?
Well, I think if you're talking particularly about the Russian hacking and sort of interference in the U.S. election in that regard, I don't think that the Chinese see that as a path that they necessarily want to follow or to take. I think, unfortunately, the lesson that the Chinese leadership is drawing, or at least the one that they're trying to instruct, you know, or to send, the message they're trying to send to their own people is, look what a mess American democracy is. You know, if you look at the sort of the rhetoric and the ugliness that permeated the U.S. campaign, it didn't send a very positive message globally. And certainly the Chinese paid a lot of attention to that. It was a gift, frankly, that we handed to the Chinese government. I don't see them thinking we need to mess around in the cyber world when it comes to the U.S. election. I think this election makes them think the Americans can make enough of a mess of it on their own.
We've spoken so far, Liz, mostly about areas of conflict or disagreement between China and an incoming Trump administration. Do you see any areas where we might get cooperation?
Well, I think, look, all areas are areas of potential cooperation and potential conflict. It really depends on how we approach the Chinese and sort of what are their own domestic interests, what are our domestic interests, you know, how do we build that confluence of interest. So certainly, look, on climate change, on global health issues, we've collaborated. On North Korea, we have collaborated. On terrorism, on counterterrorism issues, I think there are development issues, you know, in Afghanistan, and in sort of the developing in Africa, where we've started to partner, you know, whether or not these are the kinds of issues that the next administration sees as important remains to be seen. But I think very slowly, very gradually, we have begun to build patterns of cooperation with China. Again, these are areas where, you know, friction is as likely as cooperation, but there's been a very consistent and, I think, determined effort on the part of the Obama administration to find those areas of cooperation and to try to push forward on them, even if there's friction sort of all along the way.
That's a good note for wrapping up, I think. We'll close up the president's inbox for this week. Liz, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Be sure to subscribe to the president's inbox in iTunes and leave us a review. It really helps. Please note that opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by Kevin Lizarazzo, with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock and recording engineers Glenn Goldman and Dan Mudd. We give our special thanks to Audrey Boulder. This is Jim Lindsay.
And this is Robert McMahon. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on the President's Inbox.